seeing that, it just struck me that computers were like early silent film, and this was something that, as the technology improved, games were going to get more sophisticated, you know, and just as film, at a certain point, they got sound, they got color, you know, the camera movements and, you know, rhythms of cutting all became so much more sophisticated, that this was going to happen to games too.
Our guest today is a true video game pioneer. His games, for many of us, cemented the idea that a video game could deliver a cinematic experience, even before the multimedia revolution. But it might never have happened if it wasn't for the generations before him displaying great endurance, perseverance, and just being plain lucky at times, as is described in his new graphic novel, Replay, Memoir of an Uprooted Family. Jordan, thank you so much for joining us today. It's traditional in these interviews to focus on the origins of the industry and the earlier years of your career, but your new book, it goes back way further than that, way before the origins of the IT industry. What prompted you to write Replay, Jordan?
Well, back in the 70s, before I got my first Apple II computer, as a kid, like, my main passion was writing and drawing comics. And, when I discovered programming, that distracted me for about 30 or 40 years. But I've always loved comics. I live in France now, where there's an amazing culture of graphic novels, visual storytelling. And, you know, for a long time, I'd sort of had the desire to do a memoir, to kind of write a book about the early days of you know, making games on the Apple II, and just sort of how the industry evolved through the 80s and 90s. So I've done that in graphic novel form in Replay. I actually just received the delivery that I was expecting today.
Oh, okay.
It actually turned out, but there's more. Today's a delivery day. There's a coffee grinder, very important. But even more exciting, there was the first advanced copies of the English edition of Replay. Yeah, it's...
My pre-release copy really worked my inkjet printer hard. So I'm looking forward to the bound finished copy coming. It'd be lovely. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've been waiting for a long time to read this book in English. I live in France, and this book was actually published first in French, which is kind of interesting for me as an American. But to answer your question, there's three timelines in the book. Here, like on the bottom of the cover, you can sort of see that's me and my dad. When I got my first Apple II, these other bands, there's my dad as a kid in 1938, escaping from Vienna with his dad after the Nazi Anschluss. I'm American, but my family's European refugees in the previous generation. And this top band is my grandfather as a teenager when he was drafted as a soldier into World War I. So Replay is really... on the back cover, we've got three suitcases representing the three timelines, and I used three colors to sort of the reader to keep these timelines straight. So yellow is present day, me, an American game developer moving to France as an adult for a new video game project, but that's another story. Blue is my memories of the 80s and 90s making games, Karateka, Prince of Persia, and The Last Express. So I've kind of woven my memoir as a game developer, well, as a kid, and then making games through the decades of the industry evolving. That's the blue timeline. And then sepia is the memories of my father and grandfather. My dad as a kid, as a child refugee during World War II, and my grandfather actually wrote a family memoir about his whole life, but especially his experience in World War I. So all three of those are kind of braided together to make one book in Replay.
Yeah, I was going to ask about your source material, because it's a very detailed story from Austria, Hungary to Havana through occupied Europe, switching between all these timelines, a really compelling read. And it's so detailed, so you must have had some really good source material to draw off of for this.
I mean, I was incredibly lucky, first of all, to have you know, parents and grandparents who are very open about talking about, you know, their life stories in the past. A lot of families who lived through, you know, the war and traumatic times just don't like to talk about it, you know, to their kids. You know, say better not to think about or remember those things. And although what my grandparents and my dad lived through what was certainly traumatic. They've always been willing to talk about it, to answer questions. And my grandfather, as I mentioned, actually, he was a doctor in New York. He spent the first 3 years of his retirement, like in the late 70s, sort of compiling all of his souvenirs, like photo albums, documents, and he really reconstructed and wrote this 1,000-page memoir. That and this was in 1978 that he finished it, and that was coincidentally that was the year that I got my first Apple II.
Yeah, there's a frame in the book where we first meet young Jordan in the first few pages, age 14. You've got your Apple II, your copy of Byte magazine, 1978. Your grandfather's proudly showing off his memoir in the background, but you're completely distracted by the Apple II.
Yeah, and that's one of the themes of the book, really, that kids are more focused on the future, you know, than interested in the past. But then as we get older, we kind of get more, you know, the past sort of gets bigger weight, and we start to be fascinated by you know, things that when we first lived through just kind of went by in a flash. As this interview is an example, I mean, here we are talking about the old computers from the 70s and 80s, which, I mean, today there's, for me, there's a charm and a fascination in that technology, even though it's, you know, was so quickly surpassed and replaced by other things.
It's quite a big question, but leading up to that 14 years old with your Apple II, what was life like for you growing up? What were the early years of Jordan Mechner like? And where did you grow up?
So I was born in New York, and New York City. But then when I was about two, we moved to a small town about an hour outside of New York, Chappaqua. And that's the train station on the cover of Replay is, you know, that was the train that I took to go to the city. And the city, you know, New York, was, of course, where they had computer stores and, you know, video arcades and all of that started. But until age 12 or 13, you know, there were no video games or computers yet. So I was really into comics, Mad Magazine, and writing and drawing comics stories. Really from a young age, like that's what I wanted to do. I drew caricatures at local fairs kind of as a way of making pocket money. And that's how I saved up the money to get my first Apple computer when they came along. It was all the caricatures I'd drawn, you know, at local fairs. So what kind of a environment was, you know, I think it was sort of unusual. My parents were, I guess, you know, for the town, Chappaqua, kind of very laissez-faire. Like we had a big house with a lot of woods around it. And I had three brothers and sisters, and we all kind of did our own thing. We pursued whatever interested us. And I don't really recall my parents ever trying to discourage me or say anything like, why are you wasting your time drawing comics? You know, why do you keep going to the video arcade instead of studying? You know, so my passions sort of tended to orient towards film, comics, animation, and then to computers and games. And that, I guess I was kind of like always very busy, always with a lot of projects going. Most of them never got finished, but in, you know, starting in the 70s with the computer, like my ambition kind of focused on, you know, I want to make a computer game that I can get published.
Mm. Well, it sounds like a very happy, secure, lovely childhood that you had there. And you would take the train into the city. What was your go-to arcade? What was it called, the arcade you went to?
Well, there was an Electric Playhouse in Mount Kisco that was closer to home. And in the city, Times Square was where all the big arcades were. Safe and secure, I don't know. I mean, if you've seen 1970s films like Taxi Driver, and that's sort of the funny thing about those days too. It's like today, like most parents in Chappaqua would not let their 9 or 10 or 11-year-old kid take the train into the city and, you know, walk around, you know, go to the comic store, go see the matinee and, you know, in the village and, you know, all the things I did. And New York was so much more crime-ridden and dangerous then than it is now. I think that's more a reflection of how parenting has changed over the years. I think, you know, we really had a lot of freedom.
Sure. Yeah. Was it in these video arcades that you first experienced arcades or computers of any sort? Or when did you first see a computer?
I mean, I knew about computers all along. My parents had, my mom had programmed, with the punch cards in Snow Line. My dad was an educational psychologist, and so he used computers. Those were the 1960s computers, that filled an entire wall with wires coming out of them. And so there, in our basement, there was always like some strange old hardware that didn't work anymore, and sort of detritus from, my dad's previous projects. And it came in handy really once I got my first Apple II, because I was able to go down to the basement and try to find a monitor and a cassette recorder that I could plug into it, because the computer didn't come with any of that. But as far as computer games, really it was Space Invaders that I remember. Before that, there was pinball, in the local bowling alley. A lot of pinball machines always, and there was Tank War, there was Lunar Lander, and I think Knight Driver, one of the first 3D games. I mean, the 3D was really just a series of posts giving the illusion of a perspective. So those games were cool, but they were like you could only play them so much, and then like you'd seen them. Space Invaders was different because that was addictive. Like once it just took over the arcades too. Suddenly all the pinball machines were gone, and there were banks of Space Invaders machines. And that was, I would take rolls of quarters and go down to the arcade to play Space Invaders. Then there was the TRS-80, there was the Commodore PET. I guess I'd seen these computers first at school. Our school had a PDP-11, which they used for, to track attendance and report cards and things like that. But the idea of having a computer at home that I could use whenever I wanted just seemed like a miracle. And a friend of mine had an Apple II, and I would go over to his house after school. And so, I was learning how to program in BASIC. And at that time, you couldn't really learn programming in school. The teachers didn't know how to use these computers, even less than we did. But there was, there were magazines like Byte, Creative Computing, which, I would read and I didn't understand most of it. I was never really a technical kid. Like I was more on the, literary, artistic drawing side. But I really wanted to learn how to program because I saw the computer as something I could use to make things. And in particular, to make games that would, that were visual. There was a version of Space Invaders for the Apple called Apple Invaders, which came on a cassette. And that was the first game I saw that was programmed completely in machine language with high-res graphics, and it looked exactly like the arcade version of Space Invaders. So the idea that I could play Space Invaders at home to my heart's content, and not have to like keep feeding in quarters, I mean, that was like the holy grail. So one project that I, sort of my first really ambitious game project was to try to program Asteroids, which was the sort of the next big arcade game that came along in, I think it was 1980. And so I started trying to program Asteroids in machine language on the Apple II. That was around my senior year in high school.
So just coming back to when you got the Apple II, how did it come into your life? Was this something your dad went out and got, or were you pestering him? I need an Apple II. I need an Apple II. Because you were quite an early adopter for this. You mentioned the Trinity, the TRS-80, the PET. That you chose the Apple II, and then you got it, quite early on in its life. So how did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, it was my friend Ken. I was a sophomore in high school. He was a couple of years older, and he was very sort of mechanical. And his house was always full of like ham radios and things like that. He was always building things. He had a soldering iron. It was way more advanced. And so he got an Apple II, and so I would go over to his house after school and just tinker with it. So as far as getting one myself, I mean, that was, that kind of became my goal. It's like, to have a computer in my room at home that I could use anytime. So I had to save up the money to buy it. But as mentioned, I'd been drawing caricatures at local fairs since I was 9. I'd also printed up my own comic, kind of a parody of Mad Magazine, you know, parody of a parody.
And what was it called?
It was called Kooky Magazine.
Kooky Magazine.
Yeah. I also made kooky stickers, like wacky packages. Yeah. And I put little sticks of chewing gum in them. And I sold those in the schoolyard. So I had saved up a bit of money, you know, by the time I was, at this point, I was 14.
So a bit of entrepreneurialism here coming into play as well from a young age.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Since I was six, like even when I was drawing like my first comics, like at age six or seven, I would draw the price, you know, on the top, because all the comics that I saw in the store always had prices. And I just felt like to be professional, it needed that.
We're going to talking about Karateka now. You got your Apple II in 1978. Your first published game, Karateka, was 1984. And this was far from a clone of a simple game. This really was quite a technical marvel. So how did you teach yourself to code to that standard? How did you get to that level? Did you have someone to help you out? Or was this just you figuring it all out along the way?
I mean, in those days, it was really about trading tips with friends. Magazines were really important. Creative Computing. There was a magazine called Soft Talk that ran for a few years. And that was really my window into the industry. Like playing games, you know, that came on cassette or floppy disk, there was always a name on the screen, but the figure behind that name was like mystery. Like who was M. Hatta, who programmed, you know, Apple Invaders? I just imagined somebody sort of, you know, like the man in the high castle, you know, somewhere in Japan, maybe, so, you know, some programming genius. Of course, a lot of these programmers were actually not that much older than I was, but I imagined them as being, you know, just mature, you know, incredibly accomplished, you know, wizards somewhere else. So Soft Talk was the first magazine that really took us behind the scenes. And, you know, that's where I read about, you know, Ken and Roberta Williams and the Carlstons who'd started Broderbund Software. And so as a, you know, that my ambition to discover like the real software industry and to meet some of these people kind of became more concrete once I was able to read those articles. And the articles also had tips like how to, you know, basic programming, machine language programming. I would just sort of read each issue and, you know, pretty much there was always something new that I could learn from it. There were a few books. I mean, computer stores in those days like didn't have, you know, that much, but there were, you know, manuals, how to program the 6502. There was one book of John Romero and I have kind of laughed about how impenetrable and useless that book was. It was just like a list of instructions and incredibly technical stuff that didn't really help. But that, you know, was pretty much the only book that we could find about the 6502. But Roger Wagner had a column called Assembly Lines in Soft Talk magazine, which was more understandable and more useful. Hope I'm remembering that right. But anyway, you know, I would sort of collected all of this stuff and just, yeah, and there was so much I didn't know. Like there were certain instructions that I could never figure out really what they did. So I just didn't use them, I kind of programmed around them.
Right. And you talk in some of your journals about the game charts, what's number one this week, what's impressed you this week in the charts. Was that in Soft Talk magazine? I don't think we got Soft Talk in the UK. So was that where you were looking in the charts, or was that somewhere else?
Yeah, Soft Talk had a top 30 in
right.
the back.
Okay.
And yeah, it would show the best-selling games. And I read that list every month.
So you're figuring it out. You're making games like your Asteroids clone, which was Death Bounce. Is that that one? Was that a different game?
Yeah. So jumping forward. So my last year in high school, I finished my Asteroids game, my Asteroids knockoff. And I had really, like I'd gone to the arcade with graph paper and kind of copied down the, you know, the shapes of each of the rocks to make it just as accurate as possible, just like Space Invaders had been. And I sold the game to a publisher, Hayden, a division of Macmillan, who ironically is now publishing my graphic novel, Replay, first second books is a division of Macmillan. But at the time, it was Hayden Book Company who had published Sargon, the best chess program. So I sent them my Asteroids and floppy disk. They accepted it. You know, they paid me in advance. I was in high school. I was super excited. It's like, now I'm going to have a published game. And who knows, Asteroids could be as successful on the Apple as Space Invaders had been. But the timing wasn't good. This was 1981. And just about the time that Atari's lawyers sent letters to all of the software publishers saying, okay, this business of reverse engineering our coin-op arcade game hits on floppy disk and publishing it, you can't do that anymore. If you do, we'll sue you. And so Hayden dropped the project. There was actually a period of evolution where their editor kind of asked me to make it more and more different from Asteroids, you know, changing the shape of the rocks and then taking out the shooting, and until finally it just got ridiculous. There wasn't even a game left anymore.
Yeah, I guess that was quite a period of change. 1981, you had Pac-Man had come along and sort of changed the face of the arcades. Activision eating away at Atari by making games for their console. There was a lot going on at that period.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I didn't really know about home consoles. Like, I didn't have any of those. I just had the Apple II. So for me, it was the coin-op and Apple II, and everything else was kind of off my radar. I don't even remember playing console games at a friend's house.
It was just off your radar. It wasn't that you sort of looked down on consoles as a more toy-like or anything like that. You just didn't enter your life.
I just didn't know about them. Yeah, I didn't have any friends who had them. So, yeah. So about Asteroids, when that project ended, by then I had just started college. I was a freshman at Yale University, New Haven, which is 2 hours from New York. And it's kind of funny. I brought my Apple II to college. This was a time when college students didn't have computers. Like, I was pretty much the only one on the floor who did. Like, a Smith Corona typewriter was the standard equipment. And I still needed that because with the Apple, I couldn't type and print out a paper for school. It only had capital letters, for one thing. So even after I had a dot matrix printer, it was still easier to just use the typewriter than to try to put type something on the Apple and then print it out. But I spent a lot of my time programming in between classes and often instead of classes. And the first project that I did after Asteroids was Death Bounce. And that was Digital Eclipse's current making of Karateka. You know, they kind of track that period. And you know, for people who are like interested in the, you know, these early games and especially like game development, in 1981, 82, 83. The making of Karateka kind of tracks my efforts to make games leading up to Karateka. And so in detail, it's sort of an interactive, playable...
it's like a museum, isn't it?
It's like a
museum. Yes.
It's like a wing of a museum dedicated for some reason to Karateka and to, you know, those 3 years of my life on the Apple II. So they actually reconstructed Death Bounce, this game that I worked on freshman year in college, which ended up never getting published. I set it aside to do Karateka instead. But all the versions of Death Bounce are in the making of Karateka. You can play them. And Digital Eclipse actually finished it and reconstructed it as a twin stick shooter. So you can play it today sort of as it might have been, you know, had things been different.
Well, you talk about the development of that as well in your journal, The Making of Karateka. And you mentioned that you did a lot of program between classes, but a couple of observations I have from your journal is one that you didn't sound especially motivated to go to a lot of your classes because you were distracted by the Apple II, or what were the reasons for that?
Well, I was just always doing too many things at the same time. I mean, okay. I liked my classes. I wanted to go to them. And I really felt bad for like not going to classes and, you know, getting such bad grades. I always felt like I was missing.
That comes across too. You do speak about how bad it makes you feel missing classes.
Yeah. But I also really wanted to finish my games. You know, I wanted to get Death Bounce published. And then once I started Karateka, you know, like I wanted to spend a lot of time on that, you know, do it justice. But also I was a real film buff. Like I probably spent more time going to the movies, thinking about movies, and then I did on anything else with the possible exception of the Apple II.
And that also, that brings me on to my other observation from your journal, which is something that really stands out is that you're considering video games in a manner far beyond what they were delivering in, say, 1983. You use the phrase interactive movie. You say you want to, this is your quote, help create a new art form that could become as ascendant as movies are now. So that sounds quite visionary to me. Was there anywhere else around you looking at video games and saying, this could be a new art form as important as movies, or were you ahead of the curve, do you think?
Yeah, that sounds pretty grandiose for an 18-year-old. I think computers were so new. It's like even adults, you know, kind of look at it and not really quite see what they were good for. You know, this was the time when the Apple II was starting to become useful for small businesses. There were things like VisiCalc, you know, the first spreadsheet program. I mean, this was even before print shop. You know, most people didn't have printers at home, so it was still not quite clear what these computers would be useful for, other than playing games. But I think we could see that future was coming. You know, that the technology was going to continue to evolve, but as to how fast or in what direction, you know, that wasn't so clear. I mean, for me, like, I wasn't, as I mentioned, I wasn't really technical in other ways. Like, I mean, some kids, like, you know, they knew like how their car worked and how all the different parts worked together. I had no idea what was under the hood of a car then. And I still have only a vague idea to this day. I mean, I got interested in programming because I wanted to make animated movies, and the computer was a way to do that. And what was great about about Apple II computer games is that they came on a floppy disk. So you had no way of knowing who made it. And so if I, as a kid, could make a game that was good enough to put, you know, in a Ziploc bag and sell in a store, nobody would know that I was just a kid. You know, whereas my efforts to do comics and, you know, animated movies or write a novel, there was always something about them that, you know, an adult would look at this and say, I think a kid made this. But with games, because the art form or the medium was so new, you know, it was like, as it was even younger than we were as kids. So it was kind of like this free ticket to suddenly enter the adult world if we could just, you know, get good enough at doing this thing that adults didn't yet know how to do.
You could be the anonymous wizard in his castle and nobody would know. And maybe it was that love of movies that you had, and you're saying you weren't technical, but clearly you were, given the games that you produced, but you consider yourself slightly more a creative. And maybe that's what allowed you to make statements like new art form, you know, the video games were going to become as important as movies. Just maybe the right things all came together at the right time for you to see that.
Yeah, it was, really, if I'd been born a few years earlier or a few years later, like everything would have been different. And, you know, it was just the right age. The computers were already there. You know, they'd already been invented, you know, by people who were a few years older, you know, than we were then. But the ability to make games and to make software was still so new that, you know, that it hadn't yet become like a full-fledged industry. It was still possible to just kind of do something at home on your own that could actually, you know, have an impact and sort of push the technology forward. And at this time, you know, while I was making these games, Death Bounce and Karateka, I was taking classes the film studies classes at Yale were actually in the history of art department. There wasn't a film department. If there had been, I probably would have majored in that and tried to become a filmmaker. And so I was still kind of hesitating, like, do I want to be a screenwriter, a filmmaker? Do I want to keep making computer games? I was pursuing it all at the same time. And one of the things that struck me in my film classes, seeing early silent films, you know, like Georges Méliès and, you know, D.W. Griffith's, you know, black and white films, that they looked like video games in a weird way. They were, Méliès' Trip to the Moon. It's like, it's filmed on a stage and it's a bunch of people all seen in profile. You know, the camera doesn't move and all of the action is left to right. People kind of walk in one side and walk off the other. And of course, that's because they didn't yet have the technology to move the camera around. They just set it up on a tripod and filmed. So seeing that, it just struck me that computers were like early silent film. And this was something that, as the technology improved, games were going to get more sophisticated, you know, and just this film, at a certain point, they got sound, they got color, you know, the camera movements and, you know, rhythms of cutting all became so much more sophisticated that this was going to happen to games too. So that, I think that's what drew me and fascinated me.
That's a really great observation. And it's part of the reason why we do these interviews and are so, you know, trying to preserve the origins of the industry now for video games in exactly the same way as people have done for movies. So I think you were well ahead of the curve there, you know, observing this and spotting this. And as you developed your games, you seem to be drawn towards Broderbund as a publisher. What was it about them that appealed to you? You know, you mentioned you were aware of Ken and Roberta Williams, so you could have gone to Sierra Online, you could have gone to EA, Activision. I mean, why Broderbund?
So I knew Broderbund as the publisher of Apple Galaxian, also known as Alien Rain, which was it was the number one game at that time, and it was a high resolution, color, just one of the most impressive games. And I also read in Soft Talk magazine a profile of Doug, Gary, and Kathy Carlston in a sort of description of Broderbund, which made it sound like just the most wonderful place on earth to work, you know, with the most, you know, decent, ethical, kind people. And I was, as a college student, you know, on the other side of the country, you know, in New Haven, I was like, okay, that's where I want to go. It just sounds like paradise. And I sent my first game, Deathbounce, to Broderbund, and Doug Carlston himself actually called me back. That was an exciting moment for me. It was the, you know, the, we had landlines then, of course, you know, the phone rang in our college dorm, and it was the software industry on the other end. It was Doug Carlston. And until then, it had all been kind of theoretical to me. Like, I think there are people out there making and publishing software. I read about them in magazines, but this is the first time there was actually a voice on the other end of the phone line. And what Doug told me was a little disappointing. He said, you know, you're obviously a good programmer. Animation's very smooth, well done. But Deathbounce, it's kind of an old-fashioned game. You know, this was 1982. He said, this game would have been a hit last year. But now games are starting to have more kind of a story to them, you know, more engaging animation. And he sent me Choplifter, their current game. This was the spring of 1982. And, you know, I'm sure you remember Choplifter was a helicopter flying over the desert. It was kind of inspired, I guess, by the Iran hostage crisis. You're trying to rescue these people who are sort of running around and get them into your helicopter and evacuate them. And it had scrolling, it had a sort of pseudo 3D landscape, but mostly it had these little people who would wave at you, like, come and save me. And just this sort of, you know, 8-pixel high character sort of seemed like he sort of started to invest them with emotions, like, oh, now he's running, he's scared. Oh, I wanted to save him.
The helicopter's full. I have to leave that one behind.
Yeah. It was a whole, it was an interactive movie. You know, it was a story. And so seeing the difference between that and, you know, my Deathbounce, which was, you know, it was basically a triangular spaceship shooting at circular enemies and trying to get a high score. You know, that was the direction that games were going in. And, you know, so my next game, Karateka, was sort of went even further. You know, because the characters were bigger, they were more smoothly animated, and Broderbund was always the, you know, kind of my first choice. But I did also send Karateka to Electronic Arts at the same time. I sent letters to both of them saying, "Hey, this is what my new game is going to look like. Would you like to see it?" And
did they reply?
Well, actually, it's kind of funny. I found out. Like when Karateka was published by Broderbund, like the following year, Trip Hawkins actually saw it at a conference and said to Doug, "Oh my God, this, I wish we had like, why didn't we get to publish this game?" And you know, so I through Doug, I said, "You know, I actually did send
check
it
to your mail."
Yeah, it just you know, I guess it got buried under a stack of submissions, and so they never saw it. But Broderbund obviously you know, they wrote right back. They wanted to see it. I sent them the disc, and the rest is history.
So it sounds like Broderbund, you know, fulfilled that initial impression that you had of them. They were nice people, right? You know,
oh, yeah,
you
absolutely. Built
a nice relationship with them. Yeah. And so was Karateka a response to that feedback, or did you already have the seed of that game in your mind? Were you already working on it at that point?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm actually going to be giving a talk at GDC this spring about making Karateka, you know, kind of a, they call it a classic games postmortem. And so to, you know, to give that talk, I kind of dug in a little bit more. Like I reread my journals. I looked at all the materials that Digital Eclipse had assembled. And I realized that I'd kind of been remembering this like a little like cleaner than it actually was. Like in my mind, I thought, okay, I saw Choplifter, and then, you know, all my previous like arcade game ideas went out the window. But in fact, it took a long time. Karateka really evolved from, you know, my first idea was to just have two characters fighting each other on a mat, you know, and like you get points for like you do in a karate match. And, you know, the idea of having a story and putting it in a medieval Japanese setting, you know, where you have to, you know, rescue your true love from an evil warlord, that actually came later. It took many months, and the game just sort of steadily evolved in that direction. So you could say the Choplifter influence like must have been there, but it was kind of under the surface. Like it kind of took me a while to put two and two and two together, and also to kind of bring that together with you know, the early silent films that I was studying, and things like cross-cutting and you know, the cinematic presentation of things like the scene and the, you know, in the castle where the warlord points his finger and the sends the princess into the cell, and like characters are kind of showing emotions in their body language. You know, that was very silent film. And so that what all that wasn't there in the beginning. It's like the idea of Karateka sort of just steadily evolved and kept becoming more ambitious and more cinematic, you know, over the 2 years I was working on it.
That makes really good sense now when you think about the way the game cuts away to your next enemy running towards you, and then it cuts back to you and the anticipation of them appearing on the screen ready for the fight. When it comes to the development of Karateka, we go back to some of the characters from Replay, or characters, people from Replay, your father, your grandfather. Were they involved at all in the development of the game or the business of getting it into the shops?
Yeah, there's a... Here's the Karateka page in Replay. Yeah, so there in first panel, there's me at college, on the verge of flunking out of school, and then the rotoscoping, where I actually filmed my dad with a Super 8 camera and used a Moviola to trace the frames one by one.
I thought it was your dad. See, I've read in some articles that it was a karate instructor, unless your dad was your karate instructor.
Yeah, no, it was both. My dad never did a karate in his life. I actually filmed my mom's karate instructor first. And I don't have that film anymore. I don't know what happened to it. But that was all of the punches and kicks and the karate moves were Dennis. That was his name.
Okay. And was it Dennis' first time as well? Because I think I read in the journal, the first film didn't come out. You had that moment of disappointment, the anticipation of waiting for it, and then there was nothing on the film.
yeah, it was because it was an old film camera that I'd found in my parents' basement. And of course, the first roll of film, for whatever reason, just didn't work. It came out black. So I had to film that twice. But after I'd, so I sort of had to figure out the rotoscoping process. I mean, it was really tracing over the frames like with a pencil, and then using a device called a VersaWriter to import the footage. But my dad, he was helpful the whole way through. I mean, because I was doing a lot of this at home, like on breaks, you know, summer vacation, spring break, and over the holidays I'd be home and spend all my time working on the game. And so my dad would look at it and I would explain what I was doing. And he never played a game in his life. I mean, a computer game, but he was, a brilliant guy with a lot of sort of a deep cultural background. You know, and some of it goes back to like Vienna, Austria, you know, that kind of European, classical music, opera, you know, all of this. So looking at it, he could see that this was a new art form as well. Like he got it. And for example, it was his idea to put music into the game. you know, at that time, Apple II games didn't have music. You couldn't really play music, because the speaker on the Apple II just did beeps, but also because it took all of the processor's power to do those beeps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no separate sound chip. It's all on the CPU. So
my dad said, you know, can you change the pitch? And I was like, yeah, if you slow it down, you know, you can do a higher or lower pitched beep. And so he's like, well, then if you can do that, you could do a melody. So he actually composed the soundtrack for Karateka. You know, he would play on his piano, the Steinway piano in our living room. And then I would try to translate the melody into a series of tones, you know, with values from 0 to 255 to be played on the Apple. And so that's, you know, but just that idea of like getting music in there, you know, that was, you know, part of his, you know, that was a reflection of his support. And another was that he actually agreed to put on a gi, you know, my mom's gi, because she was the one taking karate lessons. And so he ran and back and forth in front of our house, and he climbed up onto the hood of the car, you know, to do the animation for the climbing up the cliff at the beginning of the game. So that was sort of like the second set of animations that I added to the game. You know, once it was sort of further in development, then I knew what the story was going to be.
Your Karateka journal concludes, 2 years, 2,000 hours since the idea for Karateka first crossed my mind. What's on the disc in Drive 1 is it. That must have been a good feeling. Did you truly feel that you'd finished it, or did you just have to draw the line somewhere and go, that's it, I've got to let it go now?
Oh, the latter, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, okay.
It's like with, you know, with a book, you know, whether it's a comic or a novel or like in any, I mean, every dev team to this day feels the same. It's like they, at a certain point, they just rip it out of your hands and they're like, this is it. This is Gold Master. And they go, oh, yeah, but there's still things that you wanted to improve and fix. There always are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it went out there into the big world, number one hit. And then you made a list. You made a list next. Your list was graduate, write a screenplay, start a new game. What happened next, John?
Well, that's funny. Yeah, you got my journal there in front of you. Well, I did all those things. Yeah, I did graduate, you know, barely, I'm sure. And I actually spent my first year after college writing a screenplay. I wrote my first film script. And somewhere in there, I videotaped my brother, David, who was 15 years old at the time, running and jumping and climbing in our high school parking lot, doing the moves that I would need for the game that I was sort of starting to envision, which became Prince of Persia. But mostly that year out of college, what I did was I wrote that screenplay.
And did you submit that somewhere, that screenplay? What became of it?
Yeah, you know, in the next volume of my journals, The Making of Prince of Persia, if you read that, you can see how at a certain point, I just stopped working on Prince of Persia because I had sent the screenplay to an agent in Hollywood who actually liked it. I mean, what are the odds? This was, I got the phone call and I went down to LA. I was living in Marin County, San Francisco at the time. And suddenly I had an agent. There was a good director, Curtis Hanson, and producer, Larry Turman, who had produced The Graduate, who liked the script and wanted to do it. And so suddenly I was going down, I was going to meetings. I mean, I was really a kid. I mean, I was 22. And I was so excited by this possibility of getting my movie made that I just stopped working on Prince of Persia pretty much for, I think, about 7 or 8 months. And this is reflected in the journal. I was doing rewrites of the script. And then at a certain point, I realized, you know, we've had a lot of meetings and it's all very exciting, but nothing is actually getting filmed. You know, maybe I had better go back up to Broderbund and finish this game, you know, because, you know. So I went back and I resumed work on Prince of Persia. And if you're a programmer, you know, it's kind of hard to pick something up after a long break. I just stared at this code and I couldn't remember what any of the things I'd written did. I was like, oh, I should have commented this code more. It feels like it's written by somebody else. But I sort of got it going again. I got my momentum back on Prince of Persia and then I finished it Three years later.
Yeah. Well, you will have your moment in film. We'll come to that a bit later, I'm sure. I've got a few questions from viewers scattered in here, so I'll just ask you a couple of them quickly. Damien Sloan asks, what was the origin of the upside down floppy Easter egg in Karateka?
So when I went to Broderbund in 1984, this was the summer between my junior and senior years of college. I had sent Broderbund the disc. They had accepted it, but they wanted some changes. So I flew out to California for that summer to basically add two more levels to the game and added, you know, some more animations, things like that. It's and again, in the making of Karateka, you can kind of see what changed, you know, between my submission version and the published version, because both of those are there, in the making of Karateka, and they're both playable. But Roland Gustafson, who was, a brilliant Apple II programmer, he was in charge of the copy protection for all of Broderbund's games. That's a story in itself. I mean, the crazy things that, Roland would put into games to try to make them uncopyable, to combat piracy. And then the pirates would immediately dive in and find ways to crack it. So Roland was actually friends with the, with pirates all over the world. They would write to him, they would call him and say, admiring his ingenuity, and putting in a certain thing and then explaining how they got around it. So it was, it was serious, but it was also like, it was just partly just the joy of hacking. So Roland taught me a lot about programming. Until then, I had just been trading tips with my friends in high school who didn't really know that much more than I did. And at a certain point, it's like, I was working at a level where there just wasn't anybody around me who knew anything about this. But at Broderbund, suddenly here were these experienced programmers who had been doing this for years, and things that are obvious to programmers, they would tell me for the first time, like how to comment your code, what's good code structure, and why you should do things a certain way. And one thing that Roland said, like he looked at my code for Karateka and he said, why aren't you using a lookup table? And the thing is, to the Apple II, it had such a strange kind of kludgy high-res graphics mode. Like you had to actually do a little calculation to figure out where on the screen or where in memory a given screen location landed. It wasn't in order. It was broken up. And that had to do with Woz's original design for how to get this thing to work and even do high-res graphics with the technology of 1976, which is basically when the Apple II, it was when the design decisions were made. So I had been doing this little calculation, which slowed down the graphics tremendously. And Roland said, look, just do the calculation, set aside like 8,000 bytes of memory to put all of the results, and then just look it up. And that's way faster. I was like, oh, that's so obvious. I mean, it eats a lot of memory, but it sped up the animation. And so once I had done that and converted the graphics in Karateka to use this lookup table, it's basically a Y coordinate table. Each entry is just the, kind of the memory location where that line of graphics begins. If you just inverse it, suddenly all the graphics in the game go to upside down. It's so easy to do. So we kind of did that and it was fun. I don't remember which of us said, hey, we could put that on the flip side of the disc. That'll be funny because then people who put the disc in upside down will play the game upside down, but they won't know why. And maybe they'll call Broderbund tech support and say, yeah, I've got Karateka, but it's broken. It's playing upside down. And then the person, the tech support person would have the sublime pleasure of saying, well, sir, it's because you must have put the disc in upside down. Try turning it around. And then the person would be like, okay, that fixed it. Thank you. And for the rest of their life, they would think that that's how software works, that if you put the disc in upside down, the software plays upside down. So Roland and I went to Doug's office, told him our idea. And we just thought, he'll laugh, but he'll say, yeah, nice. But of course that would increase the cost of goods because at that time discs were duplicated by hand on an assembly line. So the person duplicating the discs would have to actually take the disc out, turn it over, put it back in, hit a key and record a second time. So it would add, something like 30 cents to each disc sold. So obviously this being a business, sure. Doug would say no, but he said yes.
He had the same sense of humor as you.
Yeah. That was Broderbund. That was 1984.
Fantastic. Neil Smith asks, did Jordan ever play Fist 2, which was probably influenced by Karateka, or any other games for that matter that you felt were strongly influenced by your game?
No, I didn't play Fist 2.
No. Nope.
I can't think of any offhand. I mean, by the time, like 1985, 86, you know, fighting games had kind of, were kind of becoming a genre in the arcades, right?
Yeah.
I don't know exactly when these games came out. Like, I didn't really play games like, Mortal Kombat was later.
Sure. IK Plus.
Yeah.
Way of the Exploding Fist, things like that. I don't know about in the arcades. I mean, there was one game which was, I think, a top-down sword fighting game in the arcades, but I don't think there was anything around at the time Karateka came out in that style.
Yeah, I don't remember playing those games, but one game that was around and that definitely influenced me for Karateka was Swashbuckler by Paul Stevenson, and that was sword fighting, but it was side view with big characters with kind of a pirate theme. It didn't really have smooth animation. It was kind of like just like cutting between like static frames, static poses of, but still it was kind of cinematic. So I think part of my inspiration was like do something that looks like Swashbuckler, but make it with fluid animation where the characters are really like moving.
In Replay, we see you finish college, move to California, and join the games industry for real, in your words, even though you've had games published. Tell us about how the move to California came about.
So I finished college in 85, and as I mentioned, I spent that first year writing a screenplay. In 86, finally sort of reached an understanding with Broderbund about how we would do this. And the thing is that I didn't want to become an employee. You know, Doug offered me a job, but I didn't want to be a salaried employee at Broderbund or anywhere. I wanted to continue doing what I had been doing, which was to be an author. That is, I would do my own things, you know, on my own time. And so the deal I made with Broderbund was that they would give me an office, you know, where I could work. And, you know, when the game was done, if they wanted to, you know, they would have the first right to publish it. So I was actually at Broderbund for 3.5 years, and kind of moved around because I wasn't, I didn't really belong there. Like, this was like the age of independent programmer authors, you know, which, you know, like in 1982, 83, 84, the time of Karateka, you know, that was still, that was the way it started. By 1986, that was kind of on the way out, and Broderbund was, it wasn't yet like a big corporation, but it was definitely becoming more of that. There was marketing department. They had the print shop. They had a line of products coming up behind print shop. It was really moving in the direction of being a real business. So I was, in a way, I was like a dinosaur. Like, who's this kid who's like, we always have to give him a desk. What's he doing? We don't really know. It's not in any of our, you know, business plans or spreadsheets. But you know, there I was, you know, I still, you know, I knew some of the other programmers who had become employees and were working on, you know, conversions of print shop and things like that. So I got, you know, at one point I sort of got shunted off to an attic, which had just like one low window. I had fun redrawing that attic for Replay. Let me see if I can find it. But, you know, there's that's the attic.
Up in the attic there, yeah. It's just Jordan. He can go in the attic.
Yeah, my friend Tomi was also in the attic. She had an educational software company, which also didn't really fit in because that was an independent company which had a publishing deal with Broderbund. So we were also, all of us who didn't really have a salaried job were kind of there in the attic.
Okay. And so you're in there, you were working on Prince of Persia. It sounds like in the first year of Prince of Persia's development, you were just kind of coming up with your brother running smoothly around on the screen. But was the development, as you described Karateka, just sort of quite organic, see where it goes? Or did you have a more of a plan this time?
I mean, I was definitely a more experienced and organized game designer for Prince of Persia than I had been with Karateka a few years earlier. I mean, I had Karateka in mind as a model. And I knew that rotoscoping had worked for Karateka, so I wanted to do it again. I had a pretty clear idea of how I wanted it to feel, at least with the character, you know, running and jumping and climbing on the screen, and that the environment would be modular. I was inspired by games like The Castle of Dr. Creep and Lode Runner, which had these sort of puzzle structures where you would step on a plate and it would open a gate, but then another plate would close a gate. So you had to sort of figure out how to do that with traps. But with smooth animation like Karateka, that was kind of as far as my initial idea went. And then the setting of Thousand and One Nights, you know, with the evil vizier who's imprisoned a princess and you have to get out of the dungeon and you rescue the princess, you know, that kind of fit in with the, you know, the dungeon and the modular structure. But as to exactly how it would work out, like that, you know, it was sort of, yeah, as my Making of Prince of Persia Journal show, it's really a process of evolution. I had plenty of ideas that didn't make it into the final game. There were also things in the game that I had no idea of at the beginning. For example, sword fighting. My original idea for Prince of Persia was a nonviolent game where it's all just about being agile and clever and avoiding these death traps. And it was my friend Tomi who, you know, from the beginning said to me, yeah, you know, this game is not going to be fun or satisfying unless you can actually fight, you know, and win battles. And I was like, yeah, but there's no memory to put fighting into it. Sword fighting takes an incredible number of frames of animation plus the frames for the enemy. And, you know, there's just, I've filled up the Apple II's memory, you know, there's no more room.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just one conversation. We can see from the journals that Tomi constantly badgered you, come back. It's got to be in there. So she could see that had to be in there, and you came in the end. But was it not a bit unusual to be working on an Apple II game at this point? You know, surely the technical challenges that came along might have made you say, well, let's switch to, say, an Atari ST. I can have 10 times more memory to work on and make life a bit easier for myself. Did you ever consider doing that for Prince of Persia?
Yeah, that would have been smarter, wouldn't it? Yeah, and by the way, it was a pleasure to draw, to reconstruct and to draw this episode in replay. Obviously, it's in my journal, but there's so much in my journal that's kind of, like, I didn't mention it because, like, it was just the environment I was living in. You know, I didn't really say who the people were or what the places looked like because I'm just writing what happened every day. But for replay, I actually got to draw the attic. I got to draw Tomi, you know, who was so important, you know, and then our other colleagues who were around. And then to try to draw visually, to visualize that moment of finding the technical solution, which led to the creation of Shadow Man, you know, the first enemy in Prince of Persia, which was really born out of necessity, just being completely out of memory and needing to find some trick to get a second character in there. And that second character initially was the prince's shadow double, the shadow self. Yeah, if I had been working on Atari ST came later, but you know, the first PCs were out. Yeah, I could have done Prince of Persia on a machine where those limitations would have been less, and I could have put more into it. I think I was too far along. Like, I didn't want to start over. And also, as I mentioned, I didn't really love programming for its own sake. Like, I had learned Apple II programming as a teenager because I needed to know it to make these games. But 6502 assembly language was one thing. And then, like, these other processors were different. Like, everything about the machine was different. Like, I just didn't feel motivated to stop making Prince of Persia for 6 months in which I would have to learn and get up to speed on a new machine. Because I didn't have the ambition to be a professional programmer. I just wanted to make this game. And so stubbornly, and, you know, probably, I mean, was it the right decision?
Well, as you say, it led to great design choices in Shadow Man, in working within those limitations. And I think those design choices translated really, really well to the machines that could have handled it. You know, it perhaps stimulated creativity that wouldn't have been stimulated had it not been for the limitations.
Yeah, that's possibly true. And another thing is that maybe the fact that Prince of Persia was so simple, you know, and minimalist, which it had to be because the lead platform was the Apple II, also made it very portable. There's obviously the PC port, which came out, was a few months behind. I mean, that was in spring of 1990. It was a great Broderbund programmer, Lance Grudy, and a small Broderbund team they gave it better music, better graphics, better sound effects. I mean, that's the version of Prince of Persia that most people who played it, in the early 90s probably remember. That PC version was like the Apple II gameplay exactly, but enhanced. But then there were other platforms like the Game Boy, where like they didn't have that much power. So the fact that Prince of Persia could be done on those platforms, I think probably gave it a wider reach than it might otherwise have had. So who knows?
Yeah, it's on so many platforms. I played it recently on a Sharp X68000, which is a Japanese-only machine. Lovely version of Prince of Persia there. My first experience of it was on a Commodore Amiga. So there's all these ports.
And including there. A recent port to the Commodore 64. Amazing name.
Oh, okay. That's a more recent one, is it? Yeah.
And this port was done like a few years ago. It's the port that we never... Broderbund had no interest in doing at the time because, in 1990, the Commodore 64 was already a bit old. But this developer did it, for fun.
Have you played it? Is it good?
I mean, I haven't played it all the way through, but I looked at it a bit. I discovered it on social media, when the developer announced this accomplishment. And I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, Prince of Persia works on a Commodore 64.
Now, I don't know how aware you were of the British micro industry in the 80s. Over here, it wasn't uncommon for games to be turned out at a rate of one game every 6 to 8 weeks by developers and sold for pocket money prices. But here you are making games that take years. You'd been working on your Apple II for 10 years when Prince of Persia came out. Do you ever think that you pushed yourself too hard with your game development? Do you ever look back and think, maybe I should have done something a bit simpler? Or were you just too much of a perfectionist? Why did you take the games to such extremes?
Yeah, I think that's just how I was and how I still am. When I'm passionate about a project, like I just go into it, and I think it's it was time well spent. I mean, I felt like I was 21 when I started. I'm going to be 25 when this shipped. I saw my friends from college going off and like joining the Peace Corps and, going and going around the world, doing all kinds of things. And I'm like, I've just been sitting in front of an Apple II computer screen, since I was 15. It's like something's got to change. But in fact, those two projects that I did, during those 10 years, Karateka and Prince of Persia, opened the doors to so many other things. I mean, Prince of Persia, ironically, because at the time I was doing it, I was thinking, should I finish this computer game or should I move to LA and try to be a screenwriter and follow that up? Because, that was really my other passion, was wanting to make films. So I felt like for a long time that it was a choice between these two completely different careers. Like either I was making games or I would go to film school, learn how to make films and become a screenwriter. I couldn't have imagined that 20 years after making Prince of Persia on the Apple II, it would be Prince of Persia that would be the first screenplay that I sold and that actually got made into a movie that appeared on the big screen, Prince of Persia in 2010. So that's an irony that there was just, I would never have predicted, if you'd asked me in 1988.
Well, I'm going to push back on that. You say we never would have predicted it, but here's another quote from your journal. I'll stick with computers and get into Hollywood through the back door, so to speak, as computer programs become more and more like movies. So you kind of, said I could get through the back door into Hollywood. I'm sure you didn't ever expect it to happen in that way, but you did foresee that a little bit.
That's a good, fantastic. Good point. Yeah, I mean, that sounds like me, I'm afraid. But I think what I imagined at the time was something more like the direction that I went with Last Express. That is that the machines would be getting more and more powerful, that they would start to have recorded sound, digitized sound, more sophisticated graphics, and that the games that I'd be making would start to feel more and more like movies.
So the next game, Prince of Persia 2, came along, and this is during the period of the early 90s that others started to use the term interactive movie that you'd mentioned in the early 80s, and the multimedia era of computing landed. We had the capacity of CD-ROMs, games like Myst, Seventh Guest, Return to Zork. Now, with your love of film, were you not itching to take on this kind of project immediately after Prince of Persia? You didn't, but did you not feel the need to do that? What happened there?
Well, yeah, I think it's kind of my nature to always, like, whatever I'm doing, like, I'm completely, like, focused, you know, on it. But at the same time, there's always a part of me that's kind of looking at all the other things that I'm not doing. And I've just always been that way. Like, at this point, like, yeah, you know, I've given up fighting it. So while I was doing Prince of Persia, I was thinking about movies. And when the game was done, I was like, okay, that's it. Enough computer games. I went to film school. You know, I wrote another screenplay. I went to Cuba and I spent the summer shooting a short film, which I edited. So my ambitions for filmmaking were kind of not the same as what my ambitions would have been for making games had I stayed. So in 92, 93, this was sort of the period of, you know, I was still working with Broderbund on Prince of Persia 2, The Shadow and the Flame. But by then I had moved to France. I spent a year in Paris. I designed the levels for The Shadow and the Flame, like, in a little studio apartment on the Île Saint-Louis in Paris, like on this PC that kept blowing out the electricity of the building because the wiring wasn't really made for that. So I was sort of keeping my hand in on Prince of Persia 2, but really what I was doing was was editing this short documentary that I had shot in Cuba. It was just a different kind of film. It was games were getting more cinematic, but not in a way that really excited me yet at that point.
Okay, so you tried some of those earlier multimedia titles, did you? See what they were
about? I looked
at
them and there was something about it that just I didn't really connect with. I remember seeing Psygnosis, The Shadow of the Beast, like when I was sort of trying to get ideas for Prince of Persia 2, and I was impressed with how cinematic it was. Like, wow, computers can do this now. Okay, we've got to design Prince of Persia 2 in a way that takes advantage of that. But then the things about, you know, like having digitized video, like being able to play little bits of video within the game, for whatever reason, I didn't really want to do that. I was more interested in the 16 millimeter films that I was, you know, shooting and editing with 1990s technology. It was really The Last Express that kind of snuck up on me. I hadn't planned it.
Okay, because this happened in 1997. So how did we get there? How did it sneak up on you, Jordan?
So it was that year that I was living in Paris and I had discovered French and European graphic novels that same year, like Cocteau Maltese, Hugo Pratt, Jacques Tardy. Like in France, like these are the comics that like everybody who was my age, you know, in the 80s and 90s had kind of grown up with. But as a kid from New York, you know, this was new to me. Like when I was a kid, I was reading Mad Magazine. I didn't know anything about the French comics. It was a revelation to me. It was, first of all, just what the comics medium was capable of. You know, in the US, there was underground comics and there were superheroes. But in Europe, like there was everything. You know, there were the classic comics of the, you know, 60s, 70s, and then the 80s and 90s, like sort of what was then the new wave of comics. So all of that was kind of grist for the mill of what became The Last Express. I mean, to me, The Last Express, more than any of my other games, is really like an interactive graphic novel in the European style. I mean, it's set on board the Orient Express in 1914. You know, the story, the characters, the visual style. So I wasn't planning to have an idea for like a super ambitious video game that would consume my life for the next 4 years and that I would end up moving back to the US to San Francisco to make. But there was just something about The Last Express that I found so compelling that it just grew and grew. And, you know, yeah, by 1993, you know, I had started Smoking Car Productions, small at first developer in San Francisco, close to Zoetrope Studios and the Transamerica Pyramid. You know, we just started, and that took 4 years.
And there is a link back to Replay through Last Express, because you do describe it as an homage to my grandfather, my father, and his aunt Lisa, whose real life experiences reverberate both in Replay and in the Last Express's fictional story. Did your family get to play and recognize that inspiration that they gave you in the Last Express?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's definitely an autobiographical element to the Last Express, but I think it was sort of subconscious at the time. I mean, of course, my family comes from Europe, and the train, you know, the Orient Express that goes from Paris through Germany, through Vienna, you know, on the eve of World War One. I mean, that connects directly with what my grandfather experienced as a soldier in World War One. You know, he was taking his destiny depended on being, you know, put on a train, you know, through that same track. And that was the train that my dad at age 7 and his young aunt Lisa escaped on from Vienna in 1938. And that, of course, that's the story that I tell, one of the stories that I tell in Replay. So the imagery of, you know, the trains, the train stations, people with their luggage, refugees, like, the more that I researched that to draw it for Replay, this was, just a couple of years ago here in France, as I was collecting this documentation, I was like, oh, it feels like I'm making The Last Express again. And as I was drawing these panels, I was like, this feels like a scene from The Last Express. So I think the connection must have been there. Certainly there must have been a fascination also with European, with the 20th century in Europe, and how Europe went from, relative peace and prosperity, like in the 1900s, to this devastating war that destroyed Europe in 1914 to 18. And then kind of the aftershock of that, World War II, which destroyed Europe again, just 20 years later. And both of those, which impacted my family so directly. And The Last Express is really about that. So it must have been there. But I think I was, I was inspired by, partly by just the visual beauty of that era, and the idea of creating a kind of an interactive comic book, which would look like an Art Nouveau drawing come to life against a historically accurate and beautifully rendered 3D train, the Orient Express. You know, this was the time of Myst, you know, the first 3D renders in computer games. It was before real-time 3D, but the static, renders were already could be very beautiful and evocative. And so that kind of giving a certain look to the game, and also a depth of narration with having the recorded dialogue in the native languages of all this international cast of characters on board the Orient Express in 1914, like all of that became very important to me and to the team.
Yeah, the way you utilized rotoscoping again in this game, the 3D rendered static scenes are lovely, but in some other games, take Myst for example, sometimes they can be a bit soulless when there's a lot of static scenes, and the rotoscoped characters really do bring the whole game to life. The way they move is unlike any other game in that genre in that period. It's just wonderful, and I'm really glad that you didn't attempt to release it in the earlier years, because you've avoided the frustrating gameplay elements and the pitfalls some of those early multimedia titles fell into, where the game just becomes too linear in those early multimedia games. So it's a wonderful game. We have a question from viewer Ryan Clark, who talks about the real-time aspect of the game. So it plays out in real time. How did that come about? Was that a key part of your game design from the beginning, or was that added later?
Yeah, there were a couple of key inspirations. The pitch, one of the ways that I pitched it to Bertebrand was Myst with people. And so that was sort of like, I wanted to fill that environment with people And having it in the contained space of a train kind of created an environment where that would make sense. Like with the technology of the time, to have the island of mist be full of people, like, wouldn't have been possible anyway. You know, so it made sense to have a kind of a deserted island conception for that. But a train is such a contained space that I feel like if you have like 30 people, they're the same 30 people, they're the passengers and crew of the train. So they would just be going back and forth all the time, you know, wherever you went on the train, you know, most of the time, like there would be other people. And then the idea of doing them as rotoscoped cartoons was sort of a way to avoid like that sort of, you know, there was something about digitized video in games that I just didn't like. Like even if it could be technically superimposed on a 3D render or something in a way that looked okay, I felt like just the fact that it had been obviously filmed kind of worked against the idea of it being interactive. Like subconsciously as the player, like I knew that I was watching something that had been shot on videotape and that was now being played back on the computer. So it became like a choose your own adventure. Like which bit of video are we going to play next? Whereas if it was digitized and looked like it had been hand-drawn, somehow our brain believes that this is a cartoon character that we could actually be controlling, you know, with our, you know, in the same way that the little characters in a game like Prince of Persia or Mario, you know, were us, like that could be us up there on the screen.
So, they could surprise you at any moment. Anything could happen. You're not, like you say, you're not watching a played back piece of video.
So, but the question was about the real time aspect.
And, yes.
That was, you know, there was something that I never really liked about adventure games. I mean, I'd played them since the early text adventures, Scott Adams on the Apple II. And it was great that a game could tell a story, but the stories were just so clearly constructed in such a way that, you know, after exploring for hours, you walk into a cavern and there is like a blacksmith there who's waiting to sell you an axe, whatever. And it's like, so I can go there in the middle of the night. I can go there, you know, at noon. I could go there like a day earlier or later and the blacksmith is still there. It's like, it's so obvious, like it's not a real blacksmith. It's just like, it's just a convention of the game. And so even the more graphically sophisticated adventure games had this where like I always felt like the character had just been sitting there with his, you know, or her pre-programmed interaction kind of waiting for me to arrive and trigger it. But there was one game, Witness, I think it was called, or Deadline. There were two of them. I don't remember the order, but it was, they were mystery games from Infocom. And there the characters were kind of constantly on the move. So you had to sort of chase them around the house to pin them down. Sometimes you would go to a place trying to find a character and they'd already left. Like, I thought that was brilliant. You know, like I really felt like I was on my toes during this adventure game. Like if I didn't go to the right place at the right time, something could happen and I would miss it. So I wanted that for The Last Express. I really wanted to feel that these characters were going about their lives, you know, with or without me. And so that would create a kind of suspense. And of course, it was partly a trick. You know, the interactions, the conversations that were really important to keep the plot moving forward, you know, in the direction, you know, that the story, you know, that I'd written the story to take, you know, had to find ways to encourage those interactions. So there are some characters, for example, that, you know, if you don't, like August Schmidt in the beginning, if you don't go find him when he's at dinner, which you're supposed to do, he's sitting there waiting for you. He'll wait a certain amount of time and then he'll get frustrated and leave. But then if you see him after that, you'll still have the conversation, but you'll have it in a different place. And he'll make a reference to the fact that you, you know, you stood him up. So a lot of conversations like that existed in multiple versions. So it's sort of a way to catch the things that are essential to the plot, you know, would happen anyway, or almost certainly would happen. But then at a certain point, there's branches where you really missed this encounter. So the story goes in a different direction. But I tried to make the windows like as big and as accommodating as they could be so that you have the feeling that, oh, it's really lucky that I showed up just when I did because it was just in time to witness this thing. But in fact, we did stack the deck in favor of having like a dense and rich and exciting story experience, but still with enough latitude that you would feel that, you know, if you'd done something different, it would have happened differently.
Yeah, and you can go back and you can enjoy it again and, you know, do things differently. Yeah, it's a wonderful game. I love it, but commercially it didn't do so well when it came out. Why do you think that was, Jordan?
Oh, I think it was just the genre and the time. I mean, it was such an ambitious game. Like, it would have had to do as well as Myst. You know, and that was sort of the fantasy that we started with. It's like, okay, Myst has just opened up this new genre, and now, like, we can do a wonderful, ambitious, interactive adventure game, and it's going to sell 5 million copies just like Myst. In fact, there was only one Myst. And then there was Riven, which did, you know, a certain percentage of what Myst had done, but there was no other game that came close. And so The Last Express was just one of those adventure, one of those point and click adventure games of, you know, the mid to late 90s that, you know, I mean, it was, I mean, a great genre. There were some great games in that period, but in terms of numbers of units sold, it didn't approach, you know, things like first person shooters or, you know, other genres that were really growing at that time. You know, first, you know, point and click adventure games, it was just never quite became, you know, a huge mass market genre in that way.
I'm conscious of time getting on now, and I'm really appreciative of the time you've given us to talk about the early years in your career. You did fast forward earlier and talk about 2010, Prince of Persia, the movie, and the fact that you realized that dream to be a Hollywood screenwriter. I just want to ask, how important was that for you? You know, when we look back at your journals and saw how you hoped to make it through the back door into Hollywood through video games, you achieved that. So was that an important moment for you when Prince of Persia, the movie, came out? Or did that feeling come sooner for you with some of your documentaries? Just talk to us a bit about that side of your career.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, like, I've always loved film. I've probably spent about half of my time, you know, screenwriting, filmmaking, studying film, you know, and the other half, you know, making games. But I saw those as two separate pursuits. The short documentaries I made, like, Chavez Ravine, which was right around the time that, or right before going to Montreal to work on The Sands of Time. You know, that I felt like they were sort of separate, like not entirely disconnected, but separate paths. So then with the movie Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, to pitch that, you know, this was 2003. Like, I had just spent 3 years with the Ubisoft team making the game Sands of Time in Montreal. And that was something that, you know, I think I couldn't have done that had I not previously done The Last Express, because, you know, the experience of, you know, writing an interactive narrative, directing the actors, you know, all the dialogue that we recorded, the film shoot that we did for Last Express, you know, that was like the perfect preparation, you know, for writing and for recording, you know, the dialogue and so forth for Sands of Time. So after Sands of Time shipped, I went back to LA and pitched Prince of Persia as a movie to Disney and to Jerry Bruckheimer. And that was my first, you know, big time paid Hollywood screenwriting gig, which in that sense, it was a dream come true. I mean, that's what I had been sort of wanting to do since I was in college. And the fact that Prince of Persia was the script, you know, that actually got filmed is kind of a perfect irony, because it really completed that 20-year loop that had started with the Apple II.
We've got a few more questions from viewers just before we wrap this up. So one from Retro and Gaming says, are you still doing any game development for old consoles or micros in your basement for fun? Maybe even potentially something new for our old consoles or micros?
No.
I mean, if I put an Apple II in front of you, Could you knock out a Prince of Persia style game, or is it still up there?
Well, I had the pleasure a couple of months ago of playing Prince of Persia on an Apple II computer, thanks to a great retro group in Toulouse. We did an event around Replay, the French edition of Replay, and a book signing and a screening, and they had all the old games on their original consoles. So I think playing Prince of Persia on the Apple II is about the limit of my Apple II abilities at this point. If you put the 6502 code in front of me, I think I would definitely have a learning curve to get back up to speed.
I thought that when you said earlier, just taking a 6-month break from the code and coming back to it was bad enough. Never mind, 25 years. Ken Faulkner asks, if you're a 20-year-old starting your game development / screenwriting career now, as opposed to back in the 80s, do you think you'd take a similar path, or given the apparent changes in both industries since then, maybe a completely different direction?
Oh my gosh, I don't even know where to start with that one. I will say that at 20, I wanted to create in the fields that had touched me the most. So I had been super impressed with, playing video games, computer games had been really important to me, at age, 15, 16, 17. So I was really drawing on the memory of how thrilled I had been by those games and wanting to give that experience to other players. For movies, again, I had spent my whole childhood up to that point, and then my college years, catching up on 40 years of cinema history. I'd all the film, great films from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. Like, those films meant so much to me. I wanted to make films that would, again, have that kind of impact. So being 20 years old today, I think movies don't have the same role now. They don't have the same importance. Games, again, are something else. Like, there's such a mass market. There's so many different kinds of games. I don't know who I would be if I were 20 years old today, but I think whatever had blown me away the most in my recent teenage years, I think that would be the thing that would then give me the idea and the spark for what I wanted to do next, how I wanted to build on that. And I think that answer will be different for everybody. It's very personal.
You're not 20-year-old Jordan now, but you're far from finished, Jordan. So what's next for Jordan Mechner? What are you working on that you can tell us about?
Well, for the last 3 years here in France, what I've been working on, obviously there is Replay, which is the first graphic novel that I've both written and drawn. So in that sense, it's kind of a return to my beginnings, but it's also a brand new chapter, because that kind of visual storytelling is something that I've always appreciated as a reader. So now to do it as an artist, it's a new craft. It's a whole new set of challenges, and I'm really excited about that. As a screenwriter or as a script writer for comics, I've had the good luck to work with some wonderful artists in the past years. So I've actually have two comics trilogies coming out now in France. Maybe by the time this airs, we'll have an English edition of Monte Cristo, which is a modern update of Alexandre Dumas' The Count of Monte Cristo. Just a story of injustice, love and revenge. It's an innocent person thrown into prison on a false accusation, who then comes back after 15 years to take revenge against the three people who framed him. And I've transposed Dumas' story to modern day America in the post 9/11 era, the era of Guantanamo. And then today. So that's a great project with the Italian illustrator Mario Alberti, which the third book is going to come out in the spring in French, and then an English edition will follow. And there's another graphic novel trilogy called Liberty, which is about the American Revolution and the role of Beaumarchais, the French playwright, the writer of The Marriage of Figaro, who actually was smuggling arms to the American rebels in 1775 before France was willing to enter the conflict against England. And this is a true historical story, which I've written as a buddy story adventure against this background of war and politics, and then the ships crossing the Atlantic, carrying these illicit munitions.
So they're already on my wish list, then. I'll be looking out for those. For anyone else who wants to buy Replay and follow these future books, where should they go to find out more, Jordan?
So jordanmechner.com, my website. So all of the latest projects, works in progress, the things that are now available, the Replay and the other books, as well as a lot of behind the scenes information about the making of games. I have a library on my website where I'm always adding things from the archives, design documents and journals. I've also got my journals from 30 years ago during the making of The Last Express on my website at jordanmechner.com as a sort of an ongoing feature. It hasn't yet been published as a book, like The Making of Karateka and Prince of Persia, but it's kind of the sequel to those. You know, starting in January 1993, 30 years later, I started posting weekly batches of entries. So it's like that movie Deja Vu. It's a time machine, like 30 years ago this week. So every week I'm adding a new batch of entries. And at this point, it's January 1994, getting into the development on The Last Express. So jordanmechner.com.
jordanmechner.com. Fantastic. Jordan, it's been wonderful getting some insights into your life in the industry. Thank you for taking the time to chat to us. And I loved reading about your family history in your graphic novel Replay. So thank you for that. And on behalf of my viewers, thank you for the games, the books, the movies, the art, everything else that you've given us over the years. Thank you so much.
Thank you.